Hey everybody, I'm joined here by the lovely Dr. Sonia Contera. This is Adil Mian, the host of the show. And just to get started, I wanted to have Dr. Sonia introduce herself with as many or as few words as they would like.
Oh, hi, thank you for having me and for having me talking about this very interesting story and for introducing me to it. I'm a professor of biological physics at the University of Oxford, and I work on understanding the shape of living things. I'm interested in on how living organisms compute their shapes as a physicist. So in that sense, I am an inheritor of the work of Jagadish Chandra Bose, who is one of the earlier physicist that was interested in the shape and the shape of plants.
You mentioned that in one of our previous meetings that he's kind of the father of your field. And I found that really
he is. And I realized reading this story, and we can discuss that later, he something I suspected, but now I'm more confirmed how and why physicists of the periphery, if you want, get attracted by biology.
Right.
Yeah.
So we can just start with a little quote that I always like to start these with. And you've seen this quote before, and I think that you also connected to it. But it's just explaining Bose's early learning environment. And so he says, "What happens if you take a rich magistrate's son and make him learn in a village school, sitting beside the son of servants and fishermen? He'll hear tales of birds and animals and make him curious about nature. And that makes him one of India's first scientists." So early on, you can kind of see from Bose's like upbringing that he's had a very multi-faceted kind of learning environment,
and also an interest in power and in power structures, right?
right.
Answer.
Just going forward with that, did you want to talk about your general thoughts before we get into the specifics?
No, I think we can. We can just go, if you want, on the questions you have.
Okay, let's dive straight in. The story is divided into two sections. So we can pick up in the first section, which is a scientific mystery. And this kind of encapsulates the government's failings to understand what is happening with the cyclone. So I wanted to talk about and get your opinion on the anti-intellectual views that are expressed in the story. Intellectual views that are kind of expressed through the distrust of the meteorological department.
I disagree here. I think he is not expressing mistrust of intelligence or of science. On the contrary, I think one of the topics of his life is that he studies physics and he becomes really good at electrical. The effect of electric fields and the flow of electric charge on materials. So he is one of the inventors of the radio, not just Marconi. He was a world-class physicist at the time. But here's a big but. He comes to give a talk to the Royalist Institution, I think I look for it in early 20th century, 1901. Mm-hmm. So slightly after he writes the first version of the story. And during this talk, it starts talking about the effect of electric fields, not just in inorganic matter, such as I think he mentions iron oxide and tin. But he also compares, because he had been working for a long time, of the effect of electric fields in plants. So unlike most scientists of the time in the Western world, or if you want, in the countries that are more involved in the development of science from a more powerful point of view, the kind of science that colonizes India, mm-hmm. and that is so integral to the identity of these Western scientists are interested in making a science of compartments. They're separating physics from chemistry, from biology, and is assigning each of these fields a particular type of expertise and a particular way of measuring and appraising the merit of the work of individuals. So right. if like we do now, if you want to be considered important in your field, there's going to be a series of metrics that they're going to put you in.
Like hyper-specialization.
So, that's right. So part of the metric of the Western science at the time, very much 20th century, is to divide everything, to divide matter, to divide the atom. It's a very reductionist approach, which we can discuss later, why I think it's important in the context of colonialism. And it's very based on rules of individual rules that we're going to spend the world. So physics was looking for laws of simple systems, and the idea that if you break down the atom or if you break down reality into small parts and you figure out the laws, you could interpret reality. We know in our daily experience that this is not how reality happens. Reality is complex and comes from the interface of a lot of different factors that makes the systems very difficult to predict. This is what now in modern science, in modern physics, we will call complex systems. The idea that he's talking to in this story, he's not chosen to speak about the atom or planets, things that you can use with the laws of physics at the time. He chooses his topic of research as complex systems, a plant, and he chooses a topic of the story as a cyclone. Both things are complex systems, we call them in modern science, it's a biological physics and a complex system, in which the sum of the parts is bigger. Right? In which the normal laws of physics that not predict the emergent behavior of the cyclone or the shape of the plant. Yet his topic of research, and he's very militant when he goes to the Royal Institution, is about that. It's about complexity and about there's some unity in nature that would allow us. And he's against the division of sciences. And it's this moment where he decides to break with the Europeans to look for a more holistic approach of nature, to look at complex systems and how things interact, that he loses his international standing. He has started to be considered a world scientist.
Right, so we can kind of consider just taking back, rather than as a critique of the anti kind of colonial attitudes, anti-intellectual attitudes, more so to do with the unity of things.
No, he says he's criticizing the way Westerns are separating science in order to interpret reality, because in fact they're not interpreting reality. They're just doing a science that creates a power structure in which scientists become intellectuals.
Right.
But he's interested in reality and the power of science to understand reality. So he's trying to reform science. He's saying the type of science you do will not lead you to an understanding of reality, which is the core of a real physicist. That's the mission of the physicist. So he's more of a physicist than the Westerns, because the Westerns that he criticizes are interested in the power structure of the science they create rather than on the interpretation of reality. And you can see that as well happening in other Western scientists that are not part of the elite. Mm-hmm. So is this idea that when a minority goes into physics and gets rejected by the system or finds the problems, the intellectual problems of the system, is because the scientists, the physicists that are holding the structure of power within physics, they move away from the purpose. This happens always to minorities in any science, that the big guys are moving away from the purpose because they're trying to consolidate their power.
We see this.
And so it's not anti-intellectual. I think it's anti-power structure within the system. What they got is actually pro-science. It's brutally pro-science. It's the idea that reforming science, the principles of science, from a different perspective, we have a better understanding of reality, and that's why we can solve the problems. That's why the guy on the boat can solve the problem, because he has a deeper understanding of reality that is just based on these simple principles that they're trying to constrain science to.
Okay, I understand. And I think I want to bring up one of the points that you said is very interesting, is that minorities always feel their research is not taken seriously. We can see this in the work of Jagadish Chandra Bose, who I believe Waller was the person, the biophysicist who took on his work.
Yeah.
And later was awarded a Nobel Prize for it, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's always this, the people that are outside the path of success, when they are talented, they usually find the new ideas. It's that struggle between what exists and doesn't exist and the struggle for reality that brings new ideas. Because in the end of the day, what physics or science is trying to do is to have good models of reality. You know, that tension between what the establishment says and what reality is creates a lot of knowledge. And that's why you need diverse teams in scientific teams, because it's that tension between what exists and what doesn't exist, is the social tension that provokes the creativity to bring new knowledge. So that's why he was very creative, because he was confronting many things at the same time.
It led him to a depression for, I think, 12 years, he says, in one of his speeches, where he didn't have any support.
Well, no surprise. I mean, this is quite common for women in science, even now, women in physics. This conversation I have with my colleagues, women in physics in tradition, very often, that we move to areas, including myself. I moved from nanotechnology, biological physics as a new field, which I thought it was more interesting, which was new. Again, like him, moving to the periphery. You move to the periphery of science. You move to the periphery of science in search of new knowledge and new places where you can have your space, looking for reality, looking for applications. And it's very common that, for example, women in physics will go not to where everybody is, which becomes a political game, but to more difficult areas, more multidisciplinary, where you require more knowledge. And obviously, you're not part of anything. You start to be outside. And it's very difficult to be recognized. Eventually, you usually are if you endure enough. Because of that, because you end up creating new knowledge. But it's quite common. It's this movement of between this, which is something I'm interested in. I myself, as a Spanish woman scientist, I went to do my PhD to Japan. And I don't think I understood at the time what it meant. But it's these movements between the center of knowledge, the center of power, and the periphery. This always these peripheral subjects that tend to be also in peripheral places, away from the empire, from the centers of empires, whatever those empires are.
I think you can kind of find this in the story a little bit, and I wanted your opinion on this little excerpt, where the German professor at the British Association Convention at Oxford is describing gravity, right? And he says, for instance, in the country called India, the men are heavier and relatively free. The women who are relatively light are tied to the domestic space. So he is trying to describe gravity, but how it doesn't convert to the life of Indian socio-political kind of beings, and how gravity doesn't obey how women are lighter, yet they're restricted. So in a way, I was wondering if you think this is a commentary on how, like you've been saying, that physics and the kind of hyper-specialized topics sometimes are apt to describe reality in some ways. Obviously, gravity is a different thing, but there is an attempt here to...
Yeah, I think this is an interesting thing, that the choice of German and Oxford, and so centers of scientific power of physics. And these guys are giving an interpretation of a totally simple rule, gravity, which is just a normal law over R square, relating to points in space and a mass, to a very complex social behavior. So it's trying to explain the complexities of Indian society, which are endless, I think there's nothing more complex than Indian society and the relationship of men and women in India, and a generalization of the relation of women and men in India, which is so related to your social status. It's just trying to interpret that with a simple rule of that just takes into account mass and distance. And I think this is maybe another criticism of how simple concepts, So it's maybe deeper. It's the idea that Westerns, with their science, created a kind of technology in ships and weapons that allow them to colonize other countries. And this power that they extract from very simple scientific ideas allows them to extrapolate and use these very simple ideas to explain very complex behaviors in nature and in society, which then go to justify the power they exert over the colonized. Mm-hmm. And they go in color, the idea of color and intelligence. So there was, throughout all the colonial times, there's this idea of using very simple concepts of physics and mathematics or statistics to justify the superiority of the white man over the colonized. In this case, also men over women. It's interesting he's choosing this topic himself. I think it's a wider critique and pain coming from him of how simple rules of physics can be applied to such complex systems. And again, I think it's his obsession with complexity, complexity in plants, complexity in cyclones, complexity in societies cannot be explained with reductionist simple rules that are just studied for points with mass. I think that's why his interest in complex system, which I find absolutely fascinating, because you can interpret his story as the cyclone, as the chaos theory, right? The idea that if you just change the initial conditions of a complex system, you can stop it. So he pulls oil onto the sea, and in this way he stops the cyclone, because if you change the initial conditions of a complex behavior, you can change the development of the behavior. So the theory of chaos for actually weather was done 50 years after the stories were written, and they were done with the emergence of computer science. But I think for me the interesting thing is that it's difficult to understand how these ideas of complexity, of another thing he's using here is intuition, that we can go later into the role of intuition in science. So from the whole 20th century, there's this idea between what we can know from mathematics, that's Gödel, what we can know logically, the limits of logic, the limits of intuition, what is computable, what is not computable, what is simple, what is complex, and why do we need to study complex systems? So this is a fight that goes throughout the 20th century in Western science, between Western scientists themselves. But it's beautiful to see in this story that this was a social preoccupation, that actually people like him felt very strongly that there was a need to understand complex systems, and that was not achieved but oversimplifications of individual science. And I think there's a very interesting parallel here with a Japanese, I know more about Japanese physics in that time. I'm quite interested in the development of physics in Japan. And there's a physicist that was born 20 years after, he was born in 1878, I think. Jagadish Chandra Bose was born in 1858, so I think 20 years different. But he is one of the first Japanese physicists, the student of Hantaro Nagaoka, who was one of the founders of physics in Japan. And his topic of the thesis, of his physics thesis, is the acoustics of shakuhachi. Shakuhachi is a Japanese traditional flute made of bamboo, a complex system. Each shakuhachi is different. It's a plant. It's a chunk of bamboo to which you make holes. And it's one of the centers of one of the most important instruments in Japanese music, and it's very important throughout all the conception of art in Japan. So he focuses physics on a complex system, the limits of physics to understand complexity in a context of culture. He is on culture. He is Japanizing. It's complex, bringing it to complexity. And I think in both cases, there's also a reality in the way both Indian identity or Japanese identity, to a point Chinese identity again, through their histories, through their religions, from Buddhism to Hinduism to Taoism to Shintoism, there's an interesting complexity that humans are created through the complex interactions of forces, whatever those forces are, gods or whatever, and that we emerge from complexity. And I think there's this dissonance between what they know it works from their intuitions as Asian educated in a tradition of complexity and this imported ideology of the simplicity, the oversimplification that physics at that time was using, right? I think it's complicated because also within Western science, there were people contesting this idea of simplicity in physics.
Like you said, we do see a constant pressure to hyper-specialize and to, you know, have a culture that is very specific to
the reductionism, the idea that you can explain complex reality by simple laws.
Right. Thank you. Like the idea of complexity, Ania, that was very beautiful. I'll think more on that. And I think you can see, I wanted your opinion on this, and this kind of also builds upon the complexity of Indian socioeconomic circumstances, which I think he does beautifully in this by the excerpt where he explains about the pressures of Indian society. And I just found that passage really funny because it's a retort by the Calcutta Medical College, where they're asked to take on this chief officer from the meteorological department. And the retort is that the citizens of Calcutta are under the following pressures at the moment. You know, and he says, first, air. Pressure per square inch, 15 pounds. And it goes through some of the kind of, like, malaria and patented medicines and the university. And it ends with municipal tax, the last one, which is pressure per square inch, 1 ton. So you see, there's, again, this kind of complex bridging between the physics.
I think he's also very worried about society and the physicist himself, his own position as a physicist and society. Again, I think he's worried about issues of power, imperialism, being the other. So he for him is very natural to think about social issues affecting his own work, which is something, for example, women do all the time. We as women, we question all the time the social structures in which we are, because we know they're determinant of our fate as scientists. And I think he's doing that. He in everything, all throughout the story, there's this social preoccupation about the context in social context in which everything is happening, and how science, imported science, intermingles in that social space of power.
I think that's completely, that's a very valid point about how when we, especially when you look at physics, we see it as this depoliticized field. But who does that depoliticization hurt the most? Obviously, it hurts, you know, women and people of color in that sense.
But I disagree. Actually, the reason why we do physics, most physicists, is because we're looking for reality, the obsession with reality away from politics. And it's that interest in reality that makes us question the politics that takes us away from reality. So in order to strip, to actually go into the important problems and solve these important problems, we need to understand the politics, because we need to get rid of them to find reality. This is a way, if you look at how Einstein, who was again a minority, was a Jew in a very complex political environment in Europe in between the two wars. The reason why he thinks of general relativity is because he's questioning what these experiments meant, what the previous experiments about time and space and the light and the non-light. It's this question about how we perceive things, the nature of reality. He's not socially questioning who and what, but he has the ability to look beyond what is established by re-examining how humans perceive reality, which I think this is what we do as physicists. We try to extract reality. And again, this is a topic of the story, which I think I also find it fascinating. So he's interested in a complex system, the cyclone. And he knows a complex system cannot be solved by oversimplifying versions of reality, however important the Germans and the Oxford institutions come from. And he's mentioning nationalities and institutions that have a weight in power. Because he knows a cyclone is a complex system that cannot be solved. But what does he know? That human intuition is a very powerful means to understand reality. This is something, again, that every physicist knows. We are obsessed by reality, and we know that a good physicist is the one that has a good intuition. We talk a lot about the intuition. This is the legend of Richard Feynman. He had intuitions of how things work, of Dirac. Dirac would just look at an equation and know if it was good or not just because of how it looked. He called it beauty. You can call it intuition. Beauty in the sense of having a right understanding of how nature works, which is the same. So he goes back to this idea that, again, it goes into Gödel's principle, the idea that logic alone cannot interpret reality. There's things about logic, outside logic, that are important to interpret reality. And again, it goes now to theories of intelligence, of where intuition comes from, which is something I'm very interested about. And you can see in this story that the intuition that he brings in the form of the oil, which is traditional medicine, an intuition that has been bred by culture, by thousands of culture in India, is bringing the solution. So the idea that there is something outside logic that we know as humans that helps us to interpret reality, that mixture between intuition and logic, between science and philosophy, knowledge of reality are important to reach good interpretations of reality. That then you can test with an experiment, and this is the whole thing of physics. You can create a model based on intuitions and experiments. You create that model and then you test the model, either by making an application, in this case the oil, and doing an experiment. You throw the oil and it stops the cyclone. So he's showing that the scientific method plus intuition, which is embedded in the scientific method, reaches reality. So it's the tale of a physicist that is worried about intuition. And it's also the tale of a physicist that understands that the historical background of his country, of Hinduism, has also some truth. And that the truth and the religion reaches some kind of truth or truth. The purpose of religion is the same as the purpose of physics, to understand reality, to understand the role of humans in reality. So he finds that connection, which Einstein found, with most physicists found. There's a lot of physicists that are religious. Is that the preoccupation is the same. The scientific method brings another tool to understand reality, but that not remove intuition. Intuition is central to physics. And I think that's why he brings that to the story, which is, I think, very profound. It's very profound, this story. It shows his frustrations. It shows his frustrations as an Indian physicist.
I think that's what I'm, as I'm hearing you speak, thank you for your insights, because I hope the listeners are getting as much as I am out of this. The concept, especially in the second part, where you see this cultural knowledge playing, coming through. And I'm interested in your interpretation in terms of East Asian physics and its relationship to Confucianism or Shintoism as well, because we see that Bose has, you know, gone through a lot of hardship because of his Vedantic beliefs of unity, oneness, and everything. And you see that a lot in East Asian physics as well. There's the Nobel Prize winner Tu Youyou, who, you know, derived a cure for malaria from a Confucius religious text. And so you see this cultural knowledge and coming through in central figures like these people. The interesting thing that I found also is that he, the protagonist who throws the oil, is reminded by his daughter to throw the oil in the sea, which is this very little passage, but I thought it was kind of cute that he brought...
Again, it's strange. this everything surprises you in this story. So for someone very worried about social politics, of course, is less interested about the social politics of gender. But there is a woman in the story, and it's a younger woman, it's a daughter, and it's a caring daughter. So it's a traditional female role. He's very good at identifying gender imbalances with the Western men. Maybe he doesn't see that so much with the Indian women. But he does bring a caring daughter. And it's the daughter that has the intuition.
Yes, right.
The intuition of what would solve the problem is traced back to your daughter, which is... I'm not sure how I interpret this. I find it difficult to interpret. Well, it's complex. It's his own relationship with the... Because it was a mother, I could see the caring wisdom of the mother. But it's a daughter, someone new, is someone that is looking at the future, is the future of India, is the future of Bengal. And is this intuition of someone coming from the future, actually from someone more oppressed than himself, that has the right intuition about how the future will develop? Is that what it means? Is that India? Is the young India? I don't know. And I love the way he gets his imagination into characters. It's amazing. It's very rich. It's a very rich story. I want to comment on this thing of Asian philosophies and how they come from the West. I think there is a process, and certainly I can see that in Japanese science, when I study how Japanese science identity develops, of self-orientalization. So as you become the other for the Westerns, so the Westerns arrive to India to colonize, to have adventures. This is why science fiction emerges at the same time of science and colonization. Science fiction is part of the way people explore the relationships between science and power. And there's the Western science fiction, which is the story of the adventurers, the ones that go and colonize and have adventures, and they corken them with science. And this is a reverse. It's reversing it. It's using science fiction from the point of view of the colonized and actually it's breaking all the stories. It's actually... the daughter, the traditional medicine, the traditional knowledge, the intuition of the colonizer itself is the problem, not the other way around. So he's reverting, actually, the typical narrative of science fiction. But another thing I think, yeah, there's always this risk. Once you become the other, like I'm a woman because they made me so, you search for your own identity. That's the beginning of nationalism in India, nationalism in Japan, which ended up in empire, nationalism in China, the search for your own identity. And I think this is where the risk becomes. By looking into what makes you what you are, you overdo it, you start creating another of the colonization. This is the complex identity of the colonized. How you self-orientalize yourself, you're looking for differences in the West. I often find, as a woman that was in Japan for a long time, that actually that Western tradition that doesn't take into account complexity or that doesn't take into account these more traditional religions, polytheistic religions, I can also find it in Europe. So if I look at rural cultures in Spain, they're not so different in a way from the way they look at nature, from more polytheistic. I find very common ground between the beliefs of people in countryside of my mother in Spain or in Japan, a lot of common ground. So up to what point, you know, the narrative is also wrong from the Western find an other in Asia and erase their own identity in the process. And the West and the East also creates an identity. They are creations, and they forget a lot of underlying things. So these are very complex topics. But the tale allows you to see how he's looking for an identity into their own culture, perhaps not digging deeper. Perhaps in India, they also have these power structures that oversimplify what is the caste system, but an oversimplification of the complexities of reality, right? So you're trying to layer the structure of society in order to control it. Don't we all do it? Don't we all do it? And where we weigh the, where we put the weight is where you fit in the power structure and what power you have, how you revert the power that they're doing over you, how you transform that domination into, you know, how you always are trying to play the balance between submission and domination, creating narratives. This is where I find it sometimes very not satisfactory. I think both in the West and in the East, we have used complexity and simplicity and power and the relation to power in different points of history, depending where we are in the balance of power. And this is what I critical of this narrative. But his isn't very honest narrative. It comes out of frustration, of hope maybe in the daughter, and also in the solution of the problem of the cyclone. Eventually, is the intuition of the Indian people can get rid of the problem. So it's a very good intellectual. It's a very deep intellectual writing this.
I'm amazed again, as always, by your insights, because one can look at the story and think that it's a very simple and light and kind of superfluous tale. But you're right. Like, I feel, as a South Asian person myself, a lot of frustration coming in.
It's painful. It's a painful story. I just read the translation. I can't read Bengali, but the translation transpires pain, and I think maybe again, is the mark of the good intellectual. He's putting the simplicity of the story actually underscores the complexity of the feeling again. I'm quite amazed by the character after reading the story. I just knew superficially his life and his science. But now I think he was a very, I have realized what a deep thinker he was.
I'm glad I had the same kind of reaction. I just wanted maybe, we can come to the end of this, but I just wanted to get some of your insight into the kind of, we mentioned earlier, the two versions of the story. So the one that was published in, I believe, the late 80s and the 1880s, and the one then published in 1920s. So initially, the first, one of the major edits was that the first version had a solution to the mystery, which was much more based in a scientific rigor that you defined earlier with this reductionist approach, this kind of understanding that there's a counteracting the wave of rarefaction to which the cyclone was due. So that is then replaced by, you know, the mysterious workings of this traditional remedy. Would you have any kind of closing thoughts on that and what that can say?
Yeah, in this, I think I get it. I think in the first story, he was starting to be the first Indian physicist that was recognized worldwide. In the first part of the story is when he was becoming a member of the physics community of the world. He was traveling to the West and he was having recognition. And I think that maybe you can interpret that in the Scientific American thing. There is a validation of the establishment of my story. But the second revision, and it's interestingly, he revised it. And again, I think the revision means this story was important to him. This was a story where he was trying to summarize something that was important to him. And I think it's very rich, as we've been discussing. So he gets rejected by the scientific establishment in the moment he starts studying plants. And he said it's not serious that an Indian that a physicist is just starting to move towards plant physiology. And it doesn't matter how clever are his inventions, how quantitative are his results and his experiments. He's transgressed the order. He's not conforming to this rule that you stay to work in your area of research. And then he starts to be rejected and he's not taken seriously anymore. So he rewrites the story and he says, you know, I think you're wrong. I think the world is complex. And I think you need a much more profound approach to scientific search for reality. Again, going back to the story of Torahiko Terada in Japan. So he starts with the shakuhachi, with the flute, then he becomes one of the world experts in X-ray. Actually, it's argued that the Nobel Prize that the Braggs got also should have gone to him for some of his discoveries. He did some X-rays and some techniques. I don't remember what. But eventually, he founds the first earthquake research institute. Earthquakes in Japan are very important, and they're a constant reminder of the complexity of nature. However, your simple principles you are going to have to apply to reality in Japan, just lines and simple things will not construct, for example, buildings that survive an earthquake. So this is famous case of Meiji science in Japan, early, late 19th century, when they got a lot of British architects to build buildings in Japan. And they all collapsed in the first big earthquake. Whereas the Japanese traditional buildings stayed because there were buildings built on principles developed over hundreds of years with a lot of intuition and a lot of science. I mean, they do have science in the same way that India has science and mathematics before the British arrived, which is also part of the, I think, of the psychology of Bose in his story. We did science before you did. And this is something Indian scientists were starting to rediscover. India always did mathematics. It's not something you made. And we did it in our framework. So it's interesting that Terada in Japan creates an institute for the study of the physics of a complex systems, earthquakes. Again, very similar to the cyclones. Again, and also both in the case right. of the cyclones or typhoons or... And earthquakes, also very important in Japan, the typhoons, is dangerous if you are in Asia, if you are in India. The typhoons, the cyclones destroy you. So it's a matter of survival. Doesn't matter how good is your oversimplification of science. There is a reality of a complex nature that gets rid of you that you cannot overlook. And I think... his rejection by Western science when he goes into areas of science that the Westerns at the time don't think, no, we do complexity. And in fact, we're going to do more because we are facing global warming. And I think it's very similar than facing a cyclone or a earthquake, something beyond simple rules. And now suddenly we all in the world become very good at complexity science and artificial intelligence, which is actually doing that. It's the dream of Bose, to be able to do a science that is multidisciplinary and takes into account complexity. And this was, artificial neural networks were done in the 1930s by computer scientists in the West, absolutely worried about the same problems that Bose was interested. So there's a lot of complexities in these stories as well. But you can see... the fact that he goes back to his story, rewrites it, and finds an Indian solution for a complex problem, I think, is his own life. He needs to come back to India. He settles in India as a scientist. Maybe he doesn't care anymore if he gets the recognition from Western scientists, as I don't care anymore myself if I get recognition for your older... you don't care anymore about recognition. You just care about doing science. Mm. And maybe he's at that point.
Yeah, there is a reprioritization, definitely, of who do you care about validation? Whose validation do you care about? And that's a question as
That's
a young, I
right.
think for any young physicist or any young scientist listening, that's something we should think about a bit more. We should definitely think about whose validation are we valuing and who do we contribute want to contribute our efforts to.
And I think this also will free us from a lot of stress, but also will create better science. You are doing physics to interpret reality because there's a love of the world, which is the religious part, if you want. It just makes you very happy to understand the world. It's innate in us, the deep love of physics, which just moves my life. I work for the love of physics. That's all I do, because there is this profound need to understand and admire the world around us. And this is what I do what I do. That's my only motivation. And then the other thing is because sometimes you want to improve your world you're living, you want to stop global warming, or you want to understand it, become useful, like the oil in the story. And those should be our motivations. And then they're gone. They're gone once you get into the system. The professionalization of science means that there are other values, there are other things that matter more. And this is the struggle where we all are. And this was the struggle that both was having between, in order for Indian science to become important, he needed to become an important physicist among physicists in the West. And that meant a lot of things, forgetting what you're doing. And I think that's why he fought for physics. That's why the anger in the story comes up, the simplicity of the Western sciences, because they're not engaged enough in the actual mission of physics. And so I get an identity from the core of what you do. It's always been very important for many people. So it's a complex thing. And this is important to reflect on when you're studying physics. Obviously you are reflecting on it. And I think the reason why you're reflecting on it is because you come from a different background, in the same way I came from a different background. We're not traditional physicists. Well, not you. You come from a tradition of Indian physicists that is stronger than women is in science in Spain, right? So at least you have someone to look up to. I don't. Again, I think it's probably something that if you are very part of the system, you cannot do.
No, I think there's a lack of, yes, I believe the same thing. Okay. I was just kind of into the conversation so much, I forgot you were doing a podcast at some points.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. I know it's a cliche, but
no.
I can tell that you gave a lot of consideration to this, and that meant a lot.
No, I did. I did enjoy it a lot. When I read it very quickly, the story, and it didn't hit me until I started, and then I reread it, and I realized it was speaking a lot to me. Maybe myself as a sort of a strange physicist of the periphery, like he was himself. It's a very powerful story. So it's great you're doing this. So people should read the story. It's a great story.
Yes, that's the thing. If nothing else, go read the story, people. Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Sonia Contera. Again,
no, my pleasure. That was fun.
Having such a beautiful conversation.
Bye.
Okay, take care.